behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, we're revisiting a topic, I guess, right?
Yes, sir.
Carol Shelby, but in this time we're going to specifically focus on Carol Shelby, the man himself, right?
Right. In our earlier episode, which listeners can check out for free on iTunes, shameless plug, you can hear us delving into Shelby's work with the Cobra 427. Mm-hmm. This podcast is going to be a little bit different because it occurred to you and I a few weeks ago that for two guys who mention Carol Shelby so often in other shows, we have yet to do a show actually about this guy.
Yeah, I guess more of a biography piece, really.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just dive right in. How about that? And a little bit of it will be repeat from what we had said before, but we're going to add an awful lot of material to this. So, attention here, and there's some good stuff coming at the end, too, I promise.
Yes, we always have a twist.
All right, so here's the man himself, born way back in 1923, right?
Yep, January 11th, Leesburg, Texas. You may hear him referred to sometimes as the world's most famous failed chicken farmer.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that one?
I've never heard that, but I did know he was a chicken farmer, and that may come as a surprise to a lot of people, because this is the early days of the sport, really. I know it's still like, we're talking like the mid-50s when his driving career really kicked off.
Early days of racing, not chicken farming.
Yeah. Chicken farming's been around a long, long time.
Right.
Early days of sports car racing, I guess. That was mid-50s, I guess, and there were really no big contracts to be had, no million-dollar deals to be made. It really wasn't a full-time job.
Much more clandestine.
Exactly. So, you were a driver on the weekend, and then during the week you still, I guess you kept your day job, right?
Yes.
And he's he just happened to be a chicken farmer from East Texas that had this knack for driving cars fast.
And what a knack he had. Scott, I think we have, do you have a little bit about some of his early racing career?
I do. As a matter of fact, he was a driver for several teams, sports cars in the 1950s, and I'll just list them here.
I think he began as a hobbyist in 1952.
Okay, I'd buy that.
Yeah.
So mid-50s, though, he was racing for, I'm sure that through that he gained notoriety.
Yeah.
Teams took notice, or he, mm-hmm. Applied and said, hey, I'd like to drive for you guys. And they said, well, let's see what you can do. And he drove for Cad Allard. He drove for Aston Martin,
mm-hmm.
Maserati, Austin Healey for Donald Healey himself, by the way, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's prestigious.
Ferrari was one that he did. He used a Ferrari in a hill climb competition in Mount Washington, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful, and in fact, so successful that Aston Martin decided to pick him up as a driver for the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Yes, and this was after his performance with Aston Martin at Sebring. So he has earned his stripes by this time, and I think it was in 54 he was at Sebring, and so it was a little later he was at Le Mans, and just 3 years after that, he's out of the chicken raising business, Scott, and he founds Carol Shelby Sports Cars.
Yeah, you know what? I need to go back just one quick second, because in 59, this is the big point here.
Oh, yeah, this is the big switch.
In 59, he won the 24 Hours of Le Mans with Aston Martin, and that was probably what they call maybe the pinnacle of his racing career.
Right.
Now, another thing is that he was also Sports Car Illustrated's Driver of the Year from 1956 and 1957.
Mm-hmm.
He was, let's see, one more quick thing here. Ben, keep going. I forgot, there's one more thing that I needed to mention, and it's on the tip of my tongue.
Okay, well, what we'll do is talk a little bit up to one of his last races.
Okay. I've got it. Never mind. I'm going to interrupt you.
No, go for it.
Yeah, no problem. He's a Formula One driver.
Oh,
and
that's right.
And you know what? The reason that I didn't get that right away is that really wasn't something that was touted later in his life that he had this Formula One career. Very short-lived. It was from 1958 to 1959. I don't think he won any races, didn't win any championships, mm-hmm. anything like that. But this Formula One thing about him, that was kind of like, to me, an unknown. I had always thought, associated him with sports cars and then, of course, later with building cars like we talked, mm-hmm. like you just mentioned.
It's a deep cut. And this, real quick sidebar before we get to another plot twist. For anyone who is on Facebook, you can go to the Carol Shelby official fan page, which I am a fan of in my personal life. And every week they have some Shelby trivia. So this might be one of those things.
Oh, okay.
We might be giving people ammunition for the trivia.
Pay attention.
The prize is a T-shirt.
Oh, not bad.
A whole T-shirt.
Well, you know what, Ben? That's still pretty cool. I'd still like to win something like that, you know, trivia contest. Plus, if we're giving them all the ammo they need, then why not?
Yeah, I don't know why I said that as though they'd only get part of a T-shirt. Okay, but this leads us to 1960, right, Scott? And this is where Shelby is preparing to race a Maserati 250F.
Yeah, that's right. And he's still in the sports car world. And
then it hits. It hits. A month later, he starts to have some chest pains.
Yeah. So this is like a lifelong thing for him. I mean, ever since he was a little kid, he had been having heart issues. And like I think it was like a leaky valve, I think is what it was. And so even later in his career, he was actually using nitroglycerin pills. And he just was having lots of trouble with his heart. And by 1960, it got to the point where it disrupted his career enough, his driving enough, rather, that it was something that made driving impossible for him as a profession.
Right. He was diagnosed with angina pectoris. This heart condition effectively ended his career, at least as we'll see in the professional racing aspect. Now, Scott, I re-listened to our earlier show on this.
Yeah.
And there's a really cool point that you had made where we're talking about, I think we do touch on how his heart condition led him out of the racing world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in that rarefied field would be just crushed, and I'm sure he was, but instead of just giving up the ghost entirely, he decided to come back and launch a new career.
Yeah, as a constructor, as a builder.
Mm-hmm.
And this all comes from his days in a sports car. Of course, you know, when he was driving, he was noticing other vehicles that were out there. And he took note of a vehicle from a company, AC Cars, right? AC?
Yes.
A specific model car called the Bristol.
Yep.
And that's the one that we here in the States refer to as the Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
And the body that everybody, I mean, I think everybody knows exactly what an AC Cobra looks like.
Right. So the Bristol comes when he puts a Ford V8 into this.
Mm-hmm.
And a Bristol's a pretty small sports car.
Yeah, it was. And it wasn't anything exceptionally overpowered or anything
right.
in its day. But he noted that, you know, this is the kind of look and size and type mm-hmm. of car that I want to eventually build. So what he did was he stuffed a giant Ford V8 under the hood. And by giant, I mean the first one was like a 260.
Uh-huh.
And then they decided, well, it's maybe not enough. Let's jump up to 289. And then maybe that wasn't enough, so he jumps up again. And we'll talk about that later. But
okay.
He did start just cramming these big Ford V8 engines under the hood of these Bristols.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, started winning races. And Ford takes notice
yep.
and says, you know what? Maybe you're doing something right here that we'd like to kind of latch on to. How about you work with Ford and we create, mm-hmm. You know, we'll let you build the AC Cobra, as you call it, here
yeah.
in the States.
Well, we want a Ford hot rod.
Yeah, we want to put the Ford brand on it. So we're going to back this.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are we going to help you build the AC Cobra, we're also going to let you play around with our new car, mm-hmm. the Mustang.
Right. And this results in the 1965 Shelby GT350. And that's a beast. I want to talk a little bit, though, about some of the stuff, if we're okay with going back just a bit. I want to talk about some of the stuff that he was doing while this other thing was happening, while
sure.
his relationship with Ford was growing.
Mm-hmm.
He had a new outfit at the time called Shelby American,
mm-hmm.
which we're going to delve into a little bit in the next few minutes.
Yeah, it's still around.
It's still around, yeah. Spoiler alert. And their racing program with Cobra began in 1962, so it didn't finish its first race, got a DNF in October of 62, but in 63, two of his drivers took first and second at Riverside, and this begins a very, I guess, a mutually beneficial relationship that Carroll Shelby has with drivers, because unlike some other owners, right?
Mm-hmm.
He knows exactly, experientially, what's happening to these drivers, what their concerns should be. And this sort of leadership shows because as he begins the Daytona Cobra Coupe project in Le Mans, and as Shelby American and the Cobras win the GT class and they place fourth overall in Le Mans, that all happened as he was beginning to go with Ford. I guess what I'm trying to say is this guy is doing a lot of stuff, and when he got the when Ford saw what he was doing after the beginning of their relationship, Ford gives Shelby the GT40.
Yeah, that's really cool because, you know, he won in 59 in an Aston Martin. And he won in a car called the DBR1, in the 1959 DBR1. And there's a picture of it, Ben. I'm showing it to you right now.
Yeah.
That's a sexy looking car.
We got to post that.
That is a nice looking car. It's not him behind the wheel in this shot here, but
no.
It's exactly what you would think a British sports car from the late 50s would look like. It's gorgeous. And not only did Ford say, you know, like we trust you so much, we're going to give you this this new GT40 platform to play around with, because it was 1966 and 1967 that Shelby returned as team owner with Team Shelby American Inc. With you know, a couple of GT40s.
Yes,
and he won in 66, 67, and listen to the drivers, Ben, for that. In 66 for the Mark II, one of the drivers was Chris Annan. And the next driver in that same car, Bruce McLaren.
Really?
Yeah, Bruce McLaren drove for Carroll Shelby in 1966. And then in 1967, another couple of big names, in the Mark IV, Dan Gurney and A.J. Foyt. So some big names were behind the, you know, and Carroll Shelby, of course. Big names on this team in 66 and 67. But you know, those have to be, I think he probably would, you know, cherish his outright victory as a driver more than he would as a team owner, but still a victory, you know, two times in a row in this new platform from Ford, which is a really cool platform, by the way.
Yeah.
We both love the GT40. That's got to be just an amazing achievement, something that, you know, you relive that in your memory over and over and over again the rest of your life.
And some of the executives at Ford were probably doing the same thing at the time, because he helped them with one of their primary goals, which was beating Ferrari.
Yep, you got to beat the pants off of Ferrari, because remember there was that little bit of that scourge between your
scrimmage. Animosity.
Yeah, a little bit of tension. Little
tension,
that's maybe the best word for it. Remember when Ford was going to buy Ferrari and they said last minute backed out of the deal, and then Ford said, well, take this. Here's GT40.
Own you, we will crush you.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know which Ford executive that was.
Yeah. I think I have a guess. All right. So, all right. So we talked about the Shelby American Inc.
Yeah.
I do want to say one quick thing before we continue on here.
What's that?
That Shelby American Inc., it's still around, obviously. They've been around since 62. They don't just do Cobras and Mustangs and things like that. They also have a whole line of vehicles. If you go to their website now, you'll find that they have Mustang-based cars. They have the Shelby Raptor, which is a Ford truck, of course. They have a Focus. They have the Cobra vehicles, of course. They have they still have a Shelby GT40 that you could buy. And then there's also the Shelby Daytona Coupe, which is a really cool car as well. So worthwhile to look into Shelby American Inc. still and see what they're doing, because they are continuing to sell vehicles. And I guess we should say at this point that, where do we go from here? Because it's not limited to Ford. There's other stuff I want to talk about. There's the Bristol cars that, you know, we did a pretty good job of covering the history of Bristol cars in the first podcast.
Right, so as with the Cobra.
You may want to look back at that.
I've got some stuff. We have some other things that he did, that are not necessarily related as much to his race or his career as a racer. He begins to become a media personality, kind of a face of racing in the late 60s, going to the 70s. He's the kind of guy that you would see hanging out. He always, I'm going to go ahead and say this. This stereotypical media portrayal of a straight-shooting, tell-it-like-it-is Texan. Didn't mince his words.
He had that black hat on all the time.
You know, I have no room to talk with that one. And he had charisma.
Yeah, he had his Carroll Shelby jacket on that was usually unzipped to about mid-chest, you know, and he had just kind of a, oh, well, the big sideburns and everything, and he just looked the part of the of the sports racer, you know, team leader. You know, he's just, he was a hands-on guy, of course. That's why, you know, the AJ Foyt kind of reminds me of that, in that he was a hands-on guy as well. Like, he would jump out of the car and fix it during the race himself. Mm-hmm. That was the kind of guy AJ Foyt was, and I bet he learned a lot of that working with Carroll Shelby back in the, you know, the early to mid-60s. Mm-hmm. So, that's kind of the background of this guy. You're right. Stereotypical on the sidelines, you know, depiction of the racing Texan.
Yeah. Little car, big engine. He would say that. And he had a way with words. But just for an example, he starts holding these Texas chili cook-offs in 1968 and becomes surprisingly well known for it. These take off, you know. And it's funny because if you read some of the articles written about him in retrospect, there are a lot of people who say that some of that was to enhance the property value of some land he owned.
Oh, could be. You know, that he also still, his estate now owns, there's a Carroll Shelby's original Texas brand chili that you can buy right now. It's a chili kit, seasoning packets, that type of stuff you can buy. But, you know, there's like two recipes, one for meat, one for chicken. He's got the whole thing figured out. But, it's funny. These Texas chili cook-offs became a big deal at the racetracks, right? For whatever reason, they just kind of hung around for decades, right? I mean, he's doing this stuff for a long, long time.
Because chili's delicious, dude.
Yeah, I know. You're absolutely right. Yeah, perfect thing. Anyway,
I mean, seriously, the Shelby chili kits are not that bad. I think they're pretty good.
I've never had one.
Yep.
Nope. I'm gonna have to search for one here.
I'd say go traditional. Okay, I'm getting sidelined. But you know, don't dive right into chicken. Try the other one first.
Cooking with Ben and Scott. All right. So let's get back to how about we talk about Bristol cars a little bit?
Yeah.
Just a tiny little bit, and then do we want to tell you what? I'm gonna reverse that decision right now. Because I wanna leave some of the, there's one particular car that I want to talk about at the end of this podcast that I know we touched on it before, but it warrants the message again.
Well, hey, let's just hang out before I feel like we have so much stuff that we wanna say that we need to be careful not to throw it in willy-nilly. So let's take a break. Noel, if you could play some kind of relaxing music for us here. Yeah, there we go. That's pretty good.
I feel better now.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, we mentioned that it's not, you know, his career wasn't really limited to just Ford, right?
Right. Yeah. He worked with some other companies.
He did. He worked with other companies. And the way that this comes about, and I don't know if a lot of people will draw this connection, but he ended up doing a lot of cars for Dodge. He worked with Chrysler back in, starting in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Actually, way through, like, maybe, I want to say 2010, 11, something like that.
Yeah, I've got some info on that.
What's that?
In 1982, Lee Iacocca was running Chrysler, and they really needed to, according to Iacocca, they really needed to get some street cred with the performance buyers. And so that's when they get Shelby in, because, you know, at this point, it's 82, at this point, Shelby's opinion can count as a gold standard for a lot of people.
What was the name of his company?
Oh, his first one?
Yeah,
Shelby American?
Shelby American Inc. So 20 years after that. Now, you hit the nail right on the head, Ben, when you mentioned Lee Iacocca. Do you know what the connection is there between Iacocca and Shelby from years past?
I don't. What is it?
Iacocca worked at Ford as a designer at one point, but he worked with a design team that created the Ford Mustang, the Ford Escort, the Lincoln Continental, you know, the resurgence of the Mercury brand. So Iacocca was instrumental in the Ford Mustang project years and years prior, back in the mid, you know, early 60s rather. So Iacocca, you know, later said, when he's working with Chrysler as head of Chrysler, he says, you know, who we need here to really spice things up is we need Carroll Shelby, because I worked with that guy. He was a loose cannon back in the day, but let's see what he's like now. And I don't know. It seems like it's it makes perfect sense when you think about it that way. So he brings him on and he says, you know, we've got this line of Dodge cars that we want you to look at.
Right.
And, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, one of the things he does, which I thought was interesting, he is, at this point, he is becoming his own brand. Mm-hmm. Or he has already become his own brand, arguably. So he puts his name with the Dodge Shelby Charger. Mm-hmm. That's one. He's on the Dodge Omni GLH and other Chrysler cars.
Oh, yeah, lots of them. But the thing is, he there's a couple of different ways to group this. There are Dodge vehicles that, you know, bore the Shelby name.
Right.
Which you mentioned a couple
like
of them
the
right there.
Or something.
Yeah, and the Omni GLH and all those. Also, there are some that use Shelby parts, but they weren't necessarily his projects.
Right.
In that they use performance upgrades from his company. Mm-hmm. And then there were some low production numbers that were actually, or low production vehicles rather, low number production, that were actually built at Shelby's Whittier, California plant and then sold as Shelby cars. So, you know, and we're talking about cars where they may build, you know, like 500 of them at most mm-hmm. or something like that. Those are some of the really, really cool cars to me, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe the best ones. The ones that have plaques on the dash, you know, that say this is car number 415 out of 500.
Yeah.
One quick side note on the GLH. Because mm-hmm. this is a car that I think is kind of, it's been forgotten in time, but it was really cool at the time.
It slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. Do you remember seeing these Omni GLH cars on the road? Do you recall that?
I remember seeing photographs. Okay. I don't remember seeing one.
All right. Now, these were from 1984 to 1986, and the original name was supposed to be the Coyote. It was going to be the Omni Coyote or something like that, Dodge Omni Coyote.
Okay.
Carroll Shelby chose the initials GLH, which did stand for Goes Like Hell. And, you know, that was kind of the,
That was the urban legend.
That was the
for a
legend.
While.
Yeah, but it's true. It really did happen that way. And, it was just really a carryover from, like, the 83 Shelby Charger that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. A lot of the parts carried over into the Omni, which was a smaller, and not smaller, it was just a different shape body. Hatchback, real small. Then in 85, they had the GLH Turbo. Then they had the GLHS, which mm-hmm. was, the final 500 of the turbo run.
Yeah.
And these are the ones that Shelby took back to his office, modified. All of them were black. All of them, had a Shelby ECU. They had, extra boost. They had performance, you know, suspension kits. They had, of course, interiors were different. Intercooler, I don't know, just all kinds of stuff. You know, lots of upgrades. Full performance package things, you know, mm-hmm. on this whole vehicle. And they had these dash plates, of course, that I mentioned before with the number plates, which makes them kind of cool as well.
Yeah.
So you can still find those around. There are still some that will pop up here and there for sale.
Mm-hmm.
I bet a lot of them have a lot of wear and tear on them, but, I don't know. It's kind of a neat car. If you haven't really seen a Dodge Omni GLH, take a look at it, because even for the mid-80s rather, that's kind of like the early days of the street performance tuner type vehicle.
Right, yeah. Real it's early. Kind of a blast from the past in some ways. Shelby also helped develop the Viper.
Yes, that's a big one.
That's a huge one.
Yeah, and we just talked about the pace car, right?
Oh, yeah, we should talk about
Well, the pace car, he drove twice. Mm-hmm. One of them, get this, this is hard to believe. He drove in 1987. Now, remember, he's working with Chrysler from the early 80s on, so
right.
Here's this, you know, this legend. They have him drive the pace car for the Indy 500 in 1987, which happened to be the Chrysler LeBaron, which is kind of hard to imagine now at this point looking back, but it was.
Right.
And of course, Shelby drove it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1991, he was asked back to be a driver again when they used the Dodge Viper RT10, which was the concept at the time. And it was supposed to be, Ben, this is the little twist of this one, it was supposed to be the stealth vehicle. The Dodge Stealth was supposed to be the car. But it was a Japanese-built car, and the UAW, the United Auto Work Union Workers, they threw a fit over that and said, you can't have a Japanese-built car be the pace car for the Indy 500.
Mm-hmm.
What else have you got? And they brought out the Dodge Viper RT10 concept car, which Carroll Shelby again drove.
And as we mentioned in the earlier podcast on pace cars that you alluded to, the Indy 500 races always used American-made vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Every time.
Probably still will continue to
do so. I would think so. I don't think that tradition is going to change.
Now, we need to start threading in a little bit of foreshadowing at this point in the Shelby story. Now, it was May 1991, right, where he's pacing in the Viper.
Yes.
the previous year, in June of 1990, he had a heart transplant.
Yeah. He had to go through a heart transplant, which, of course, saved his life, obviously. I mean,
right.
And it kept him going for a long, long time. I mean, that's a big deal for him. I mean, he had suffered with this since he was 7 years old, all the way through until 1990, which is, what, 70-some years old.
And it inspired him, his survival.
I bet it did, yeah. Yeah, it inspired him to help others, right?
Yes, sir.
And he did found a charity, which is called the Carol Shelby Foundation.
And I think that the mission of this foundation is noble. There's no other way to say it. It funds heart transplants for children, correct?
Yeah, and kidney issues as well.
Ah, yes.
But it does fund, it helps out children and families of children that have, additional expenses due to medical costs. So, you know, it's a very, very good cause, and it's still around, obviously. But it's been around since 1991. He founded it in 1991 because he was inspired by, the help that he received in the medical field when he needed it most.
Right. And the part you mentioned about kidneys, that's very important as well, because in 1996, his son Michael donates a kidney to Carol Shelby.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know he did that.
Because he had kidney issues. But he's working the entire time, because in 1997, he's partnering with Oldsmobile on the Shelby Series 1 car.
Incredible.
So he's
incredible. Yeah,
some fight in him.
I had some notes about the Series 1, but I think I want to skip that for now.
Okay.
And let's move back into maybe some Bristol car stuff. You want to do that?
Yeah, let's do Bristol cars.
How about we talk about leading up to the we'll lead up to the 66 Shelby. How about that?
Yes.
Because I think that we talked about the AC Bristol cars, as I mentioned in the April of 2011 podcast.
Yes.
And we talked about the Mark 1, Mark 2, which were the 260, 289. By 1965, Ben, this is amazing. He was putting 427 engines in these AC bodies, these AC Bristol bodies.
Right.
Calling them Cobra, of course. And the one term that comes up most is this is a mean car. I mean, that's probably the best description of this thing is it's the meanest street car you'll ever drive, the 427, right?
Yes.
Now there are a couple of versions of this that we talked about. Most of them were actually, and this will surprise a lot of people, but the 420, most of them were actually 428s. The 428s, which are still badged as 427s, were the street car version of the 427. And the 427s that were truly 427s, that had an actual 427 displacement, those were the race engines. And those are the ones, Ben, that are that are described as the mean. I mean, not only the 428s, but also the 427 racing engines. They were like they were much, much stronger.
Yeah, I've got a great quotation from Shelby himself about this.
Sure.
When I built the dual supercharged 427 in Cobra in 1966, I wanted it to be the fastest, meanest car on the road, just like you said, Scott. 40 years later, says Shelby, it will still kick the tail out of just about anything in the world. It's the fastest street legal Cobra I've ever owned. And he estimated the 0 to 60 mph there at a little over 3 seconds.
All right. So the that's amazing.
For a street legal car?
That's incredible. And that's okay, when we're talking about the 428, which is the street version,
right?
These are SC cars, which are semi-competition cars. The other version, the 427, which is a true 427, and the race engine, that's a full competition car, and very few of those remain. This is the one that has the 42-gallon fuel cell in the back. It's an enormous fuel cell in the back, but. Man, what a car. And that wasn't the top end either. There was one more that he built. He only built two.
Are we talking Super Snakes?
You know what? It's time to talk about the Super Snake, because I've been dying to get to this the whole time. But I know we covered it quite a bit in the other one, but I just want to quickly talk about it because it's so cool.
So what makes it different then? I'll set you up.
Well, what makes it different is it's what is it? Twin. It's twin supercharged. Mm-hmm. So it's got twin superchargers, an overhead valve V8. 0 to 60 time is, again, it's a 427. 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds, and that's in 1966, Ben.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I accidentally let the cat out of the bag too early because that quotation, you guys, that quotation is Shelby talking about
That's okay. No, it's all right. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because you know what? The other ones are pretty darn close to that.
Yeah, but they're not that close.
Well, not that close. But this is the 800 horsepower beast that we talked about Bill Cosby owning it for, what, one day?
One day.
One day. And then he sold it. And it was just too much power for him to he was too scared to drive it.
And that's literally a true story, you guys.
He was literally too scared to keep the car. Mm-hmm. It then sold to... oh man, this is one of only two. Remember, he
right.
There's Carroll Shelby who owned one who built it for himself, mm-hmm. and then he built one for Bill Cosby who was a friend of his at the time.
Yes,
and a car enthusiast, obviously. Said it was too much car for him, so he sold it or he gave it back to Carroll Shelby. Mm-hmm. They sold it to another guy who, unfortunately, the guy drove it. This out. This thing is a monster.
Yeah,
the guy drove it off a cliff and into the Pacific Ocean and died.
Yeah.
His name is Tony.
Tony was the driver.
Maxie, I think, was his name. Mm-hmm. And then it was bought by somebody, fully restored, mm-hmm. and then sold again. And there's a guy named and I heard somewhere that Bill Cosby said that it's now owned by another guy, another entertainer, right? His name is Jimmy Webb, I think, and he's an American songwriter, composer, singer. Mm-hmm. But Jimmy Webb is now in possession of the car that Bill Cosby once owned for one day. It was driven off a cliff into the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
Killed its owner. Then it was restored, and now Jimmy Webb owns this car mm-hmm. again. And then, of course, there's the original that Shelby owned, which I don't know if that's the one that – is that the auction vehicle?
The one that got the $5.5 million auction price?
Yeah, I mean – Ben, I tell you, like, I was so excited to talk about this car again, and I know that it's a little bit of a rehash of what we talked about, just a little bit, but man, there's so much about the Super Snake, from those days that is worthwhile mentioning, mm-hmm. and they still continue to this day, I keep thinking of the name, the Shelby American Inc.
Oh, yeah.
They still continue to build cars that they call Super Snake.
Right, yeah, but they're not the original Super Snakes.
It's not,
you know
it's
what
not
I mean?
One of those two, no, but they do, and boy, one more thing here that I have to mention about Super Snake is that recently Hot Rod Magazine did this comparison. It was a really cool comparison. It was between a 427 Cobra and a 2011 Super Snake that was created or constructed by Shelby American Inc., mm-hmm. Which they're still doing to this day, but this is a 2011 example. Now, regarding the 427 Cobra, they called it the baddest, nastiest, just meanest car that's right. ever been driven in their competition and in their comparisons. It was an extremely rare car. It's just a really raw car as well. They said mm-hmm. that it was just like, you know, the bare elements of a car, really. I mean, it was just the meanest thing. Loads of power on demand. And get this, this is the 550 horsepower version. It's not the 800 horsepower version that we had just mentioned, you know, the Super Snake of the 427 Cobra. So, and it weighs something like 2,460 pounds, right? Well, then they have this 2011 Shelby Super Snake, which is a Mustang-based car mm-hmm. that of course, Carroll Shelby's company makes. 750 horsepower, Ben, in this thing. It's a 5.4-liter supercharged V8, and it weighs about 3,950 pounds. So it's quite a bit more, you know, it's a lot heavier than the Cobra. Now, Carroll Shelby himself in this comparison, because he was interviewed during this, he said about that 5.4-liter engine that's the finest engine that's ever been built in an American car, or rather in America.
Wow.
That 5.4-liter supercharged engine. So he was really, really happy about it. And he said for a long, long time why they waited to build the Super Snake was because for a long time they were limited to about 500 horsepower. But that they changed some things around at mm-hmm. Carroll Shelby. They did what they had to do to make it work. And they got the thing up to like 750 horsepower, something that would be, you know, a worthy, I guess, of the Super Snake name. Because they don't just put the Super Snake name on anything.
Right.
I mean, that's something that Carroll Shelby takes pretty seriously. Mm-hmm. So he hangs on to that until, you know, they get up to about 750. But it's just to give you an idea now, he said it was ungodly fast, the guy that drove this thing. Mm-hmm. It just says power when you need it. It's just like a stock Mustang when you don't need it, but any other time it competes well with the 427 Cobra. So there is a modern version that you can get your hands on out there.
Yes.
If you can't get one of these ultra-rare 427 Cobras or, you know, a kit car version of it, if you mm-hmm. can't get an original, there's something modern out there that you can get from Shelby American Inc. that will sort of maybe hold you over a little bit.
Now, Scott, at this point, before we wrap up anything, we need to anticipate our listeners here, because we tried to cover some stuff, and I think we did okay, but there's a lot of stuff that we just couldn't get into this podcast, right?
Yeah, we hit a few of these, a lot of them. We didn't touch on his education, mm-hmm. Which was shortened due to World War II. I think that he was actually he graduated from high school in 1940. Mm-hmm. He was enrolled at the Georgia School of Technology in the Aeronautical Engineering Program, but the war started up. And he went off to serve, of course, and he became a World War II aviator. And he ended up graduating with the rank of staff sergeant pilot from there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. He raced in sports cars. We mentioned that. He raced
right.
in F1. We mentioned that. Stopped due to heart issues. We talked about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, let's see. Le Mans victory as driver and owner.
Right. Yeah, we got that.
He set land speed records in Bonneville. We didn't talk about that.
We did not.
He was Sports Car Illustrated Driver of the Year. We talked about that.
Twice, right?
Yeah, he was inducted to the Automotive Hall of Fame in 1992. We missed that.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh. I mean, he founded his own charity in 1991. The guy has his own brand of chili, Ben. he was a genuinely good guy. I mean, whatever project he touched, he seemed to breathe like life into that project, and it became a Carroll Shelby project. And I think that's why, you know, some of these big manufacturers like to work with him on this real high level, you know, like they enjoyed having him associated with their brand, and he liked being associated with them as well.
And he continued working toward the very end of his life. Carroll Shelby passed away on May 10th, 2012, just a little more than a year ago as we record this.
Yeah, that's not that long ago.
Right, and that was in Dallas, Texas. And when he passed, he left behind a legacy that endures, is going to endure for generations after him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds a little bit corny, but it is true when you think about how one person could change not just the face of multiple car companies, but also more than one industry. I mean, I'm not even counting Chile. This man has led an amazing life. Now, he didn't always stay away from controversy. It is true that Car and Driver magazine had at times some disagreements with him, for example. People will remember stories about lawsuits that happened in the course of his career. There was for a time a little bit of controversy about the Shelby Foundation even. And it's no secret that Carroll Shelby did not always agree with the Shelby American Automobile Club.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of controversy, but you got to think about how long this guy's career was,
exactly
what he did, and honestly, like the charity thing, that was all cleared up relatively mm-hmm. quickly. But the news did come out that there was some kind of something funny going on there, and eventually they found out that wasn't the case.
Right.
Then there was some dispute over a car company that was going to use some badges that they had, the Super Snake badges,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what name it was, like Kraft Car Company or something like that. They were going to use the badges. And so that's another lawsuit. And, of course, his name is drug out there again.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that there were some other disputes with, you know, just here and there. I mean, lawsuits. And that
yeah.
happens when you're the head of big corporations like this. And you've got so many different lines in the water. Something's going to go wrong at some point here and there. And you just have to kind of put out the fires as you go.
Yeah. And I love that you say that phrase. Am I rolling over you?
No, that's all right.
Are you sure?
Yeah, positive.
All right. So he was 85 when he was, if you will, squashing the beef, resolving things with Car and Driver specifically. And the reporters who wrote the stories about him had the sense that he knew his time was limited.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quoting from an article there.
Sure.
And he wanted to make sure that he had set the story straight. And so he resolved a lot of these things, and he passed away, as we said, in 2012. He had been ill for some time, and the ultimate cause of death was listed as pneumonia. But he was 89, Scott. That is an enviable age.
Yeah, sure. And to work right up to the end, and mm-hmm. to be successful right up until the end. I mean, it didn't really trail off. I mean, I don't think I'm overstepping my bounds here in saying that he was probably a household name for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was an automotive icon. I don't think that there are many people that you could mention the name Carroll Shelby to, and they wouldn't know exactly who you're talking about, or in their mind almost immediately picture an AC Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just one of those things that, you know, people will associate. Even people who aren't really, you know, car guys or girls. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Carroll Shelby, and I think that they'll know who that person is. I really do. I feel that. I know we're intimately involved with the automotive world. We know, you know, all about him and everything. But I think someone outside would also get that mental image.
I've got something for us to end on.
Sure. Right?
Okay. This comes from a line by journalist Stephen Cole Smith, who wrote an excellent article that I've been looking at for a lot of this podcast. Shelby often said that if he had been better at raising chickens, he would never have had to resort to his career plan B, building and racing cars.
Really?
Yeah, and we are so glad, Mr. Shelby, that you decided to get out of the chicken industry.
Plan B, huh?
And
if he had been better at raising chickens. So he says that he wasn't a great chicken farmer, right?
It sounds like something he would say.
It does sound like something he would say, yeah.
Well, so we are going to go ahead and head out, you guys. We hope that you have enjoyed our exploration of the life and times of Carroll Shelby. Write to us. Let us know what you think. If there's another anecdote that you would like to tell us about, or
there have to be. I mean, the guy was 89 years old and a total character. Mm-hmm. There have to be stories out there that, you know, maybe even some of our listeners have had, you know, some type of personal contact with him.
Yeah.
So if anybody had met him or, you know, had the pleasure of, you know, going to his shop in mm-hmm. Texas or California, or just meeting him, tell us about it.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about Carroll Shelby, you can check out our website, howstuffworks.com. You can just type in Shelby and Cobra in the search bar, and you're going to have a couple of really cool articles pop up. We can post them too to make it easier. And you can find them on our Facebook. We are Car Stuff HSW. You can drop us a line on Twitter. You don't have to have something important to say. You can just say hi. We'll say hi back.
Everything's fine.
We're cool guys. Or, you want to get a little bit more in depth, say, you can send us an email directly. We are
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.